This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Midterm elections are just about 2 weeks away, and we are looking this week at one of the North Carolina key races, the fight for a seat on the state Supreme Court. The rules for voting on that office have changed over the last couple of years. The General Assembly passed legislation that now makes the Supreme Court race partisan. Lawmakers also eliminated the judicial primary, so now more than one candidate from each party can appear on the ballot. Supreme Court justices hold 8-year terms with at least one seat on the ballot every even year. Justice Barbara Jackson holds that seat now, or one of those seats. She is running for re-election to serve a second term. She's running as a Republican and faces challenges from Republican Chris Anglin and Democrat Anita Earls. She served 6 years as a judge on the North Carolina Court of Appeals, and before she took office, she practiced law, worked in Governor Jim Martin's office, and served as general counsel in the North Carolina Department of Labor. Welcome to our show, Justice Barbara Jackson. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I appreciate your covering this important race.
Good to have you and talk about it. Let's get a little of your background. You did undergrad and attended law school at UNC Chapel Hill. How did you develop an interest in the law?
I think probably from a young age I was interested. I was a voracious reader, so it was kind of a good fit. And when you're a liberal arts major, you kind of have to figure out some way to put that to good use.
Law was it for you. And before you ran for the Supreme Court, you were elected to the Court of Appeals, and you served there for 6 years, right?
Right.
Talk about what made you decide to run for office?
Well, when I was working for Commissioner Barry in the Labor Department, I was noticing that there were decisions at the Court of Appeals I just didn't agree with. And I also, some folks from my peer group had started running for the court. And I thought, you know what? If these folks can do it, I can do it. So I went through a program called the Institute for Political Leadership, which is a nonpartisan program. At the time, it was based in Wilmington. Now it's over in Greensboro. And they basically teach you how to run a political campaign. And a number of folks who are graduates are in elective office. Elaine Marshall is a graduate. Our Chief Justice, Mark Martin. Wayne Goodwin, who's chair of the Democratic Party and who was formerly insurance commissioner, is a graduate. So we've got a pretty good roster of people across the state, several folks in the legislature as well, in the judiciary.
What was the environment like then for women running for office? Were there barriers, do you think?
I think fundraising can be a little tough if you're a woman. One of my challenges in 2004 was I was really a very unknown candidate, and my opponent was far better known than I was. It was the first year that we had public financing, and there were two Democrats and two Republicans in the primary, and I found it difficult to make it known to people that if you wanted me to qualify for public financing, I needed to get my donations before we ended the primary season. So I didn't qualify for public financing that year.
The General Assembly has made a change. They moved to make the Supreme Court race partisan again, and it was partisan at one time, so it's not like it's the first time in our state. What do you think, what's the impact of that? Is that a good idea to have partisan races for judges?
I think it's a mixed idea. I appreciate on the one hand that people seem to be more comfortable voting when they have more information, and that the party identification is more information. You'll probably see less people drop off in voting for other candidates who have political affiliation identified than you would in a past election. But the thing I worry about is not that the judiciary would be more politicized, but the perception that it's more politicized. We're running more of a political campaign.
And talk about that, because it is an interesting quandary, it seems to me. On the one hand, I do want to know who I'm voting for. So, yeah, I'd like to know a little bit about your ideology. I want to know how you think about these issues before I cast my ballot. On the other hand, you are, in both cases, we're going to talk to a Democratic challenger as well as your other Republican challenger in the next couple of days. There is a party affiliation. You'll be having to rule on cases that are brought by a majority party in this moment, the Republican majority. How does that affect you? How do you manage? Let's start with the way you as a judge have to take a case when you're a declared Republican and you've talked about your conservative credentials. How do you manage that ideology on the bench where you're looking at a broader context?
Well, I think what's important is my judicial philosophy. And I've been clear, I believe in judicial restraint. I believe that our judges have a limited role, and it's reviewing the decisions of the legislature, not interpreting, not acting as a super legislature and substituting our judgment for theirs. So that informs how I make my decisions. And, at this point, I've written over 700 opinions or around 700 opinions, and I think folks can take a look at those. I think in terms of the information that's out there, I think there's a lot of information available to the public about us. We've got websites, we've got Facebook pages, we have Twitter accounts, so you can get to know us a little bit there as well. The state of North Carolina actually publishes a voter guide and sends it to every registered voter in the state. And I think that's really helpful information as well.
What about the, now we'll talk about the public perception side of it again. Once we know your affiliation and you talk a little bit about your ideology, I'll put this in a broader context because we're seeing more and more about the courts becoming politicized. Are you worried that the public is losing confidence in the judiciary in its role as a third branch apart from that process?
Well, the Code of Judicial Conduct Act actually requires judges to ensure that the public does not lose confidence in us. You know, we're called upon to maintain public confidence. I think that's a very important value that judges have. And I think the public should maintain that confidence. Our court actually reaches unanimous decisions between 75 and 85% of the times. And that statistic ranges over the past 7.5 years since I've been on the court. You know, there certainly is always a lot of attention paid to high-profile cases. And that's true of the United States Supreme Court. That's true of our court. But those aren't the bulk of our cases. You know, we're dealing with criminal law. We're dealing with contracts. We're dealing with the termination of parental rights. In fact, we're going to add about 100 cases next year because those cases are going to start coming directly from the district court to our court. And so there's a lot of fairly basic work that goes on in the court. We also get the rate-making cases from the Utilities Commission. Those come straight to our court. So there's a lot of things that really have no veneer over them that really could be considered political. And our court does value the ability to work together and to get to a unanimous result whenever we can. We think it's good for the people of North Carolina, for the law, and for the legal community.
And you've talked about, you said you've participated in over 700 decisions, the bulk of them not political and they don't make a lot of headlines. But the ones that do are important because they have a direct impact on civic life and political life. So when the court had a Republican majority several years ago, you were on that court. The majority twice upheld redistricting plans that were drawn by fellow Republicans in the legislature back then. And those plans were later overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court as unconstitutional. Talk about your decision to ratify or to approve those redistricting plans.
It's always a little bit challenging to talk about that subject, and particularly because it's still pending in our courts. We actually, you know, the case Dixon v. Rucho has been up to the Supreme Court and has been back to our court and then back to the Superior Court, and it's actually still in our court. So I really can't discuss it. I will say, I think sort of as a broad principle, the U.S. Supreme Court in a lot of redistricting cases, and I know some of the cases that they've handled in the past decade have been unanimously decided in opposition to the way our court handled them. But in many redistricting cases that they look at, they split fairly closely, too. And I think whenever you see them splitting closely on issues, it makes it more challenging for any state Supreme Court to deal with the issues.
Well, but also splitting right along ideological lines. And again, this gets back to this confidence question. Confidence about what is primary, the bedrock, which is the right to vote in the United States of America.
And the right to vote cases, the voter ID cases have not been heard by our court. That was actually in a parallel track up through the federal courts.
No, but redistricting. I mean, that has
that
has profound impact again. I mean, you know, we've seen, you know, sort of all of the detail on how many voters vote for Democrats in the state of North Carolina, and yet our representation comes nowhere in our congressional representation doesn't reflect that. And that suggests that maybe the democratic process has become distorted.
And I think just sort of in a broad sense that there has been ongoing litigation on redistricting since I got out of law school. I just can't comment specifically because the case is still pending in our court.
What is talk about the day in the life of a justice. You talked about all the cases. In fact, I'd like to redirect that and talk specifically about the new cases that you're going to see, the parental rights and authority question. What's happening there?
So the legislature made the determination that we would get jurisdiction over those cases. And if I can just correct one statement earlier, I've actually authored about 700 opinions. I've sat on several thousand cases.
Thank you for that correction.
This will be about 100 more cases for the court next year. And what they've been handled at the Court of Appeals on what are called 3.1 panels. And the court really tries to get those out very expeditiously. Justice Beasley, Justice Ervin, and I all sat on those cases while we were judges at the court. The three of the other justices who were previously on the Court of Appeals have heard termination cases. Two of the other justices have heard them over at the court, and the other justices have heard them on our court. But it'll be a little bit more challenging for us. We all have the value that these cases need to be heard as quickly as possible. Our court generally has heard oral argument in every case, except a very narrow slice of cases. When they come before us, that's not going to be possible in these cases. So that'll be a really dramatic change for us. And it's going to be a dramatic change for us to try and really have an expedited track for cases to come out of our court, too.
Does this change make sense to you? Do you think this is where it belongs in the first strike?
Well, you know, the thing with our court is that the General Assembly does get to have a say-so in the parameters of our jurisdiction. They also made a decision a couple years ago to move the business court cases into our court. So they go directly from our business court, which is a specialty court in the Superior Court, and they come straight to our court instead of going to the Court of Appeals first. Utilities rate-making cases, capital cases, they all come straight to our court. A number of years ago, they made the decision two classes of cases moved from coming straight to the Supreme Court to going straight to the Court of Appeals. The first-degree murder cases that resulted in a life sentence and the first-degree rape cases moved from hitting the Supreme Court first to hitting the Court of Appeals first. So it's, you know, the jurisdiction, they tinker with it over time.
Another thing the General Assembly has tinkered with is rules around the election by eliminating the judiciary primary. So now instead of having one Democrat and one Republican in the general election go head-to-head, this rule, essentially by eliminating the primary, allows more than one candidate, and that means that you are now facing a Republican challenger as well as a Democratic challenger. Talk about that rule change. And again, you know, if you think about your job and what your role is, what kind of impact does this these rules have on you, both having to run a campaign and then as an associate justice?
Well, it really is like having two full-time jobs. You know, and I guess I've been very involved in court technology over the past several years, and I think the benefit of that is that I've been able to create an office that, for my part, is paperless. So wherever my laptop is, my office is. So that's very helpful in these kinds of circumstances. But, you know, I mean, honestly, I expected to come into this campaign season and run in a two-person race, having had a primary. So this did turn out to be a bit of a surprise, and I would certainly rather be going head-to-head with Ms. Earls. But that's not the way that things worked out. So you deal with the hand that you're dealt.
You talked about technology being important to you as part of one of your areas of focus. Tell us more about that.
So in 2015, the Chief Justice created a commission on the administration of law and justice, and one of the areas he chose to have us focus on was technology, and he appointed me to chair that. We came out with a number of recommendations. One was to establish a new website for the court, which we did this summer, nccourts.gov. I hope your listeners will check it out. The great thing was it's replaced a 20-year-old website, and we're mobile first on that site rather than the dinosaur that we were. The other great thing about that site is it's the platform for electronic filing when we get that put in place. And we've had an RFP out on that, and we'll have e-filing with electronic case management. And the beauty of that is it's going to make it much more convenient for citizens and lawyers and our judiciary, our clerks of court. It's going to reduce paper storage. Right now, our counties have to provide paper storage for the volume of files that get filed every year. Citations, those take up a tremendous amount of space. So a lot of economies with technology.
I am talking with State Supreme Court Justice Barbara Jackson on the state of things. She's running for re-election, facing two opponents in this upcoming campaign and election about 2 weeks away. You know, you talk about technology and how things have changed. I want to talk more about your judicial philosophy, your philosophy on the bench. And you talked about not wanting to legislate from the bench. But the thing is, when you go back to the intent, what does this law say? It may have been written at a time when technology and the demands of the times were much different. How do you weigh those two things? Times have changed, and population centers, all those things change. What part does that change play in your decision-making from the bench?
Well, that's interesting. You know, and the U.S. Supreme Court certainly has grappled with that, with GPS and iPhones and those kinds of things, and what right you have to search. And I think some folks, when they look at the U.S. Supreme Court, see that they seem to be more comfortable with technology when it's something that they use, like a GPS or an iPhone. And I think that's probably true. But I think it's important for those of us in the judiciary and the legal profession to stay current on technology so that we can deal with these issues and try and find some commonality with them if we're having to relate them to some other provisions in the Constitution or laws. But the good thing about North Carolina is we're not dealing with a constitution that dates back to the 18th century. We're dealing with a very modern constitution that dates to the 20th century. Makes our job a little bit easier.
But even so, and I know you don't want to get into detail, but if you take even a case like redistricting, it is precisely the fact that the amount of precision that can be brought to drawing those lines is so much greater that informed the justices who ruled against these lines to say, no, this is actually categorically different. And even political gerrymandering, which, as you know, has been the rule of law since for over 100 years. It's been hard to overturn that, and yet this sort of crossed the threshold. So their technology did play a big part in saying, yeah, we know they've had the right to do this for a long time, but wow, things have changed.
Yeah, and I can't talk about it. It's if it's in the court, it's something right. That's just verboten.
But, I mean, that's the kind of a thing that you'd have to take into account. So it's not just, regulating GPS, but it's how it affects almost every aspect of our lives, even since our Constitution, the state Constitution has been written, changes.
And I'm a fan of Twitter, and the two of the things I tweet out about these types of things, and not cases pending in our court, but when I see something, a broad legal concept, are hashtag Brave New World or hashtag Skynet, depending on whether it's a little bit nervousness or a little bit of, wow, this is the new frontier.
Great stuff. What a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate being here.
Justice Barbara Jackson is currently serving on the North Carolina Supreme Court as a Republican. She is running for re-election to serve a second term. This week, we will talk with other candidates for the Supreme Court as well. Tomorrow, we talk with Anita Earls. On Wednesday, Chris Anglin. Early voting is underway until Saturday, November 1st. You can find details at our website, stateofthings.org, a program produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.